This is the Homegrown Hashishin Podcast, the first podcast to focus exclusively on the single-source solventless home grower. Whether you are a solventless legend or just starting your journey, there will always be something to take away from our show. We support the hobby hashmaker and aspiring hashmakers by sharing knowledge and techniques while interviewing some of the best hashmakers in the U.S. making hash from home for the joy of the process. Sit back, fire up a dab, and we hope you enjoy the show. This show is brought to you by the Don't Worry Be Hashy Discord, the best place to connect with other hashmakers and learn or teach others to get better results and better medicine at home. Follow at don'tworry_behashy on Instagram or go to www.don'tworrybehashy.com to request an invite to the Discord. We do group pheno hunts, monthly giveaways, and share genetics to help each other get greater results faster with limited home grow space. Tap in and join the hash fam.
All right, welcome to another episode of Homegrown Hashishin. I'm your host, Cinema Sungrown. Here with me is my co-host, as always, Don't Worry, Be Hashy. Hashy, how you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I need to take some dabs here because I had to get two fillings earlier and I fucking hate going to tennis.
Oh, that's yeah, it's the worst. Yeah, like the best is the dab hits before the dentist. That's the way to operate in my experience. Well, on that note, like today we've got a great guest. He's a grower, a hasher, educator from the great state of Colorado. Please welcome everybody, cannabinoid. We're just going to call you Ben though, if that's all right with you.
That works. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
That's great. So I guess you've got a lot going on. I think more so than most guests will ever have on here. So I think it'd probably be best for everybody that isn't familiar with you just to kind of run down your CV a little bit and talk about what it is that you do. So the floor is yours early on here to do exactly that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I appreciate it. So the long story short is Hashy and I actually met at Mizzou in journalism school years ago. I went from there, did the ad agency scene in Chicago, and then found my way out to Colorado. I have been consuming cannabis for a long time. Colorado was legal at the time and Illinois was not. And so that was very attractive as someone who worked remote. You know, a lot of the work that I do is as a writer, freelance or contract related. And that's evolved over time. But I was drawn to Colorado. Cannabis was legal. I started throwing cannabis events, hikes, campouts, disc golf tournaments, things like that. Met a lot of growers, met a lot of extractors, met a lot of people in the industry as a whole. And that trended towards writing opportunities. And so I started ghostwriting and co-authoring with people in the space, whether they were actual licensed operators or nutrient companies or genetics companies, people like that. And, you know, have since evolved even in that and started growing myself eventually. And that led to a variety of changes, but eventually it led to me teaching other people how to get started growing. And so, you know, this idea of growing as a hobby and being a hobby grower is something I'm very loud about on the internet. And, you know, making hash as a hobby, it's something that is new, I think, to a lot of people who are familiar with cannabis because of the previous mentality surrounding growing and doing some of these production methods where you wouldn't take those risks unless there was some sort of profit on the table. And now that things are legal and things are accessible and there isn't necessarily that need to have that ROI, you know, we're opening a lot of new doors and somebody has to help guide people once they come through the door. And so that's what I'm trying to do is make that information accessible and approachable and digestible for, you know, hobby growers of all levels.
It's interesting. Years ago, there's a brew store that's near me here in Northern California, and they do workshops and you come in and you do your own, like how to brew your own beer, and you go through the whole process with them. Yeah, essentially that's kind of what you're doing, but from a remote standpoint, right? I mean, it's just introducing people to the craft.
Yeah, the Growhort started as just that. It was a remote program designed that like we could take you from start to finish. In 100 days, you know, you'd be smoking your own weed by 420. We start first week of January. And yeah, remote support, remote maintenance, remote guidance, and then live sessions, educational materials. You know, I'm available as a kind of a mentor and guide and ask me all the questions kind of person. So that's also, you know, you both know it's hard to find in this space with the way that questions are sometimes handled online. So
gatekeepers, got no patience.
Gatekeepers, for trolls, yeah. With nothing better to do but to start a flame war in the comment section.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the Growhort thing. That is such a cool idea. I mean, just in looking into it a little bit myself, I mean, you provide everything end to end, like from all the equipment all the way through. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience is like for someone that takes part in it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea behind the Growhort started from a writing program that I took. And, you know, as someone with a background in writing, writing is not necessarily something that you can learn overnight. But I watched what this program was able to compress into a 30-day period and how they simplified things so that it was focused on the actions and doing the thing that you were learning rather than the learning. Most people don't want to learn. They want to do whatever it is that they are needing to learn how to do it. And so with growing, you know, there are a lot of things that prevent people from ever getting started, whether that's trying to buy the right equipment or trying to figure out why they can't use their credit card on the website or, you know, all the things that we're very familiar with. But if you're a brand new grower, you're like, why is this so hard? And so on top of that, then it's, you know, obviously keeping a plant alive. And the idea was like, okay, I am not necessarily an expert grower. I don't consider myself to be an expert grower by any means, but I know more than I did, you know, 3 years ago at the time when this started. Like 3 years ago, me would ask me questions now and I would be able to answer them. And so how do I make this as turnkey as possible? I'm not going to teach you how to grow the best weed. I'm not going to teach you how to grow outdoor weed. I'm not going to teach you how to blow out your basement. Like what I'm going to teach you how to do is exactly how I started. One plant in a tent, in your house, like the place you live, you know, and just as simple as possible. And then same with the nutrients, you know, are a very simple process. And then running with autoflowers again, like everything that could remove a variable was the idea. Like, let's make this as foolproof as possible. And we've still had issues. We, you know, you can't control nature. You get a mutant seed or, you know, things of that nature, but overall, it has been a successful event. You know, we've evolved with each cohort, and our next cohort, actually our harvest party is on Sunday. So I'm harvesting tomorrow and that's all going to hash for the first time. I've kept it all for flower each time. Kind of nice to have that range of metric about what you could expect to yield. But hash wise, I'm excited to see what these do.
What do you got coming down? So,
auto flower, huh?
Yeah, so we run auto flowers. We've been running the banana split autos from Ethos. I have previously run their autos or had previously run them. Did a big test. I ran a few, just a full auto run. And the banana splits were, you know, it gave kind of a tropical terp profile, which is cool. If you're new to growing, you want something that just doesn't smell like just like weed. You know, you want something new and cool. And oh, that smells different. It also was, you know, fairly easy to grow as all things considered. And most importantly, it's a 70 to 80 day. So you can go from seed to harvest in 70 ish days. You know, and we have like, I'm taking mine to day 84 tomorrow. That's kind of the hard limit I tell them. And again, that's based on our timeline for the program. Like there are some plants that you may not want to take, and some people don't take their plants. They let them go, and that's up to you. But like, the idea is to get you to a point where you can make that decision when it's time to chop. Yeah.
Definitely. The auto is a great place to start, honestly. My first ever plant was an auto, like an early lowrider. Like we're talking years and years ago.
Yeah.
I had a 48 inch cabinet that I was growing in my old condo, and it was like with an HPS 400 water underneath it, and so I only had, you know, 2 feet of headroom for that thing to actually grow out of a little like squatty deep water culture. so the auto thing made complete sense for me at the time. Like, well, this thing's going to stay short, you know, like there was no other option for it. But I think that, like you said, the idea of removing variables for a new grower is such a smart approach from an education standpoint. Like that's everything.
Yeah. We are the point of failure, you know, like in most cases, like it's the grower, it's not the plant. If you can remove times that you can screw up, then you're going to have a better success rate.
Well, and something I've seen is a lot of people struggle. I've seen people struggle when they start because the natural thought process is I'm going to start with these cheap seeds. Like I love growing marijuana as a seed site. Great site for cheap seeds. You can buy single seeds even, or three packs and six packs, and it's essentially all white labeled. But everyone I've seen that starts there is kind of getting subpar phenos. And then you go through that first pheno hunt and you want to keep your keeper. So then I see people keep a clone around and run it four or five times over the course of a year. And then it's like, they finally realize like, this is not that good a weed. And I think what you're doing is great, helping people start with the simplicity, and you also taking the time to kind of select something based on its ease of growing. Something I saw you do a few months ago is put together that kind of beginner's guide to hash as well. Kind of tell us how the Growhort has transitioned, or if you have kind of future plans of, you know, connecting those two dots of here's how to grow and here's how to make hash.
Yeah. So, and even before that, I just wanted to touch on like, from a variable standpoint with autos, like you remove that burden of like keeping a pheno around, you know, and like, oh, maybe this is the one. You're like, it doesn't matter. It's going to die. You can't clone it. You're not going to, it's not going to stick around. It's not going to be you hit a home run on the first one. Don't worry about it. Just grow it. But then, yeah, on the point of hobby hash, you know, that came out of the Growhort. So the first Growhort cohort was last January, and one of the students ended up at a resort in Mexico with one of my friends out of, who's based out of Los Angeles, and he's an extractor and a consultant. And he does a lot of things, but they just happened to be sitting next to the bar at this random resort in Mexico together. And we're talking about various things, and they both knew about, you know, the Growhort. And so my buddy Saman is an extractor, and Saman was talking to this guy, and he was like, oh my God, you know Ben. So, well, I'll come to find out he had his proxy with him, and he had some amazing water hash from California that made its way to Mexico some magically way. And so they, you know, he came back, the student came back and was like, I want to learn all of this. Like, how do I do that? How do I make that at home? And I was like, okay, like I could do a lesson, like one of the, because we do 13 live sessions and various topics. And this was the first one. So I'm like also trying to brainstorm what topics are important to the growers. So I was like, oh, cool. I'll just do a live session on, you know, hobby hash real quick. And I'm taking all these writing courses and doing these things and building out assets and, you know, lead funnel magnets and, you know, the marketing side of this world. And was like, okay, I'll build a free hash course. And like, if you've taken an EEC for most of these companies, educational email course, they're not very substantive. Like they give you information, but they're not like, it's not like you just read a textbook. And so when I put this together first, it was like a 90-page PDF. And I was like, oh, this is way too deep. But I already told everybody I'm giving it away for free. So fuck it. Like, let's do it. And so that was basically the building block. And so I tied it into the Growhort because, well, one, I premiered it, but we do it as the harvest party. So as the harvest party, we talk about hash and we talk about extraction and we talk about, like, aside from flower, like you just chopped, what else could you do with this? You know, and like that was kind of the inspiration behind it. And so the Growhort gets a live walkthrough. Like every Growhort, like when we do the sessions at the harvest party, we go through the materials. I also update the document, you know, every cohort, which is every few months, with just random things. You know, sometimes it's small tweaks, sometimes it's like new techniques that are coming out, or just a slide on, you know, here's some trending things you may hear that are starting to become a thing, like the sonic cures and Pietella and all these, you know, other phrases that start to float around the community and eventually make their way out to the larger, broader audience. So that's, you know, the Growhort gets the most updated version. They get a live walkthrough. They can ask questions and do all those things. With my next harvest, you know, being tomorrow and being for hash, I am curious to see how this genetic performs for hash. I've hashed the parents. I did a banana daddy auto, which is one of the parents. And that was actually the first plant that convinced me to fully transition to solvents. So I did like 4.2% at the time. Yeah, I was really... Yeah, out of an auto. And all so right. At the time, you know, I may or may not have been experimenting with hydrocarbon extracts and wasn't doing a great job of getting yields. You know, again, small tent grower, yields are important. Like if you take a whole plant and you don't get much out of it, like that's tough. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to try this. It's an auto, like we'll give it a try. And then I hit 4%. It was like, you know, 4% isn't a 5% or, you know, whatever standard you may have for washers, but it was double what I was getting with my rudimentary extraction methods. And so
if I'm hitting 3% with an auto, I'm pretty stoked. Like, yeah, like 3%. I'm like, that was worth the time. Right. Like for the terps. Right. But like 4% on autos, like,
and I think about it, I'm like, man, what if it had done 1%? And I was like, screw this solventless stuff. I'm never doing that, you know? And like, that was the turning point. Like, so things happen for a reason. But having done that, like, I'm curious to see what this is, because I'm pretty comfortable with the range that we tell people from a flower standpoint. You know, you're going to get between 2 to 4 ounces off of your plant. You might get more than that. But on average, of all the students so far, that's pretty predictable for what we can expect. Hash, I don't know. You know, like, I can give you a theoretical idea based on growing a lot of weed and making a lot of hash, but like, I don't genuinely know the genetics we run and the setup we run. How does it hash? Like, theoretically it should do X, but does it? And so I think that that'll be cool. And maybe open doors, like you were saying, for transitioning the program for beginner hash makers who like are avid hash consumers who want to start growing to make hash and not just to grow because they want to enjoy the process and flower and, you know, all the other.
Well, and then you get into like, are you starting them from clone at that point? Or are you saying to them, like, look, hey guys, we're going to do a pheno hunt.
Yeah.
You know, pop one whole pack.
So I am not a fan of group pheno hunts. And I know that that's controversial to some people, but like with the autos, obviously it doesn't matter, but with photos, you know, I think it really depends on the quality of the group. You can absolutely do it. I think like if you have a partner and they grow really well, it's easy to do with two people. Three people gets harder. Four people, so on and so forth. There's more room for failure. There's more room for things. Also, you're sharing cuts between a lot more spaces. And so even if someone does find a winner, maybe they have some sort of random fungus that's only present on the East Coast. And now all the other growers have this new fungus in their grow. You know, like there's mm-hmm. a lot of, I'm not saying that it can't be done. I just generally haven't seen it accomplished on a consistent basis where I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Cause I've had people ask in the class, they're like, we should do a group photo hunt. And I'm like, we can all just grow a weed and like talk about it and share photos and like support each other. But like, I'm just going to hunt the packs that I have. I don't.
Yeah. Well, and then that becomes a liability in a way tied back to your grow hort. I've experienced the same thing. Like, I am a fan of group pheno hunts because of the potential behind it. But I've experienced the same thing. I think an interesting thing recently is a buddy grew out the clumps, which I've hit from clone 6% RTH. I've had other people hit 6%, but he hit 4%. So that was like an eye opener of like, you got to tweak something else in the grow. And then that then leads to the question of like, what potential was there behind his 2.8%er that we wrote off from a past group pheno hunt? Maybe that was a 5%er under other conditions that had an amazing terp profile, but just based on pure yield results, you write it off. So that as an example, if you got 8 different growers that are at 8 different skill levels growing out 8 different cultivars and multiple phenos, you can't really fully trust everyone's selection process. And I've kind of moved away from trusting RTH numbers. The way I look at it is it's just a baseline. If someone tells me it's over 4%, that's good enough. I'm not going to even trust the 5, 6, 7, 8%. I had somebody else reach out to me recently asking about the potential of like clone degradation. Cause they're like, hey, I washed this in the past and it hit 8%. And now I just washed again and it hit like 2.5%. What would cause that? There's a lot of different things that can cause degradation of a clone, or just changes in the growing different styles. You know, there's so many factors that you can't really decipher that, especially like remote, trying to like consult with somebody and kind of decipher, like investigate with them of like, well, it could be this or it could be this. So I'm with you on that, as well as primarily the transfer of whatever's in your garden. I'm to a point where I only like to trade snips with people just based on knowing I'm not taking on anything root bound or anything soil bound. And it's a lot easier for me to inspect and treat and manage as I take that in and plug the pucks and everything like that. So I totally get why you would avoid that. For me, we've ran 5 group hunts at this point on the server. And out of, you know, it's like that's 40 different cultivars with 8 people per group hunt. We've collected 3 plants out of that so far. You know what I mean? So it's
and
not.
And the 3 plants that may be worthwhile, you know, like it's, I'm not saying it's not worth it, but it's also, you bring up another interesting point about like with 8 growers, you know, pheno hunting is another controversial topic depending on who you talk to, but the idea of like truly pheno hunting and truly seeing how resilient a plant is and vigorous and dominant, you know, it is taking it in different environments and going from soil to cocoa to hydro to deep water to outdoor to greenhouse and seeing what that, how consistent that plant is. But most of us, when we say we're hunting for our situation. I grow in soil under LEDs. I'm hunting for a soil grow in LEDs. This shit may blow up in hydro, but that's not what I'm growing in. And so like, and to your point, like if somebody selects something, even a great grower, if they're growing in rockwool blocks and their plants are just blowing up because, you know, there's no restriction on the roots. Well, I may not have that experience because I'm growing in a soil mix. And yeah. I might be disappointed with that. I'd be like, why did you choose this one? It's terrible for growing in soil. And they're like, well, it blows up if you put it in a cube. So
yeah, totally. 100%. And I've also seen plants kind of correct themselves over multiple runs whenever you switch from cocoa to soil or soil to cocoa, where that initial transfer of nutrient source is like a big shock. But when you start to take cuttings from that new growth a few weeks later, and then you do another round of clones, it's like by then it's a little bit more acclimated to whatever your nutrient cycle is and your lights and how you keep your humidity and everything in your environment. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting take. So in relation to that, me and you have talked about this outside of this conversation before. What's your take on pheno hunting as a small hobby grower? For example, I've had people tell me I'm not actually pheno hunting because I'm only popping 1 pack. You got to pop 100 beans to truly pheno hunt. And I'm like, okay, what should I call it then? I'm growing multiple phenos of a cultivar and I'm making a selection. Is it a micro hunt? I don't really care what nomenclature you want me to use. I am hunting for a pheno. So how do you do that in a small or also in combination with a limited plant count based on different state regulations?
So one, I put anytime somebody's talking shit about anything that I'm doing, I'll just put hobby in front of it. So I'm not pheno hunting. I'm hobby hunting. And like, and I'm hunting as a hobby, you know, like whatever you want to call it. Like, that's what I'm doing. Like,
that's a great tactic,
but like, yeah. But to an extent, it's like what I'm doing is a hobby. And so whatever I'm doing is on a hobby scale. And so like, it's, if it's easier and it helps not ruffle your feathers, we'll call it the hobby hunt tent instead of the pheno hunt tent, whatever, you know? And that helps a little bit, but I think that there is some controversy on it. You know, I was on the Dude Grow show with Jordan Rivers, and we were talking about this. Grow one plant, you're technically pheno hunting because that plant is a pheno and you're going to see what it does. But the discussion came up and, you know, there seems to be this magic number of 16 that's based in ag. I don't know. To me, if you're hunting, like as a hobby hunter, it's an AB game, right? You can hunt 2 plants side by side. Which one do you like better? Boom. You know, and then do that. I have friends who did this, who grew in closets and things in, you know, downtown apartments, and they hunted packs. They would just do it 2 at a time. They'd find the winner, then they'd pop another seed and they'd grow them against each other and they'd do it again until eventually they had one that, you know, survived the challenge, so to speak. What I've been doing recently is a little bit different. I had this weird fear of losing cuts, specifically cuts that I had not found yet. And it prevented me from popping packs that I was like, I don't want to pop that pack because there's going to be something amazing in there. And then I'm going to have to keep it for the next however long. And I don't have room for that. And, you know, there's an obvious bias there that there's a keeper in every pack, but there's also some impracticality to the redundancies. You know, like, it's obviously best practice to have a mother plant that you're taking clones from, and then, you know, you're doing all of the things to have redundancies. You wait until the clones are rooted before you flip or kill your mother, and you do all these things. But like you mentioned, with a plant count, that gets hard. I mean, let's be honest, a full clone tray is violating most plant counts. Like, even if you're a bad cloner, you're not taking one clone of every plant. Like, you're cloning a tray because you're like, hopefully 10% of these make it. And if they do, like, you know, if all 50 pop, then you've got 50 plants now. And yep, so that's,
you gotta throw 42 away.
Yeah, so like, I like to joke, you know, like, the number one rule of Grow Club is we don't talk about plant count, but like, it is a factor in how you make decisions, especially when you're hunting. And it's something that's limited me, you know, for that reason. I've only, when I like will pop something, I'll typically pop like at most half a pack, like five seeds, you know, four or five seeds, or I would only pop a couple seeds because that was the amount of moms and clones and things like that that I could keep around in my space. And I have a good friend, he goes by Weed Shanty online, and Weed Shanty's been a mentor to me in a few different ways, but he pops a lot of seeds. And so, you know, with the plant count question aside, more logistics wise, I was like, okay, you're keeping a mom of each of these, you're taking two clones of each of these, you're waiting until that happens to flip each of these. Like, how are you popping so many packs? Like, I don't even care about the plant count. Logistically, what are you doing to make this possible? You know, there's so much at risk with mislabeling and cuts not rooting and all of the things you have to do to scout plants. And he was like, well, think about it, how many of those plants are actually going to make it to harvest? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, if you haven't sexed them, you have males, and you're also probably going to have herms given the current gene pool. And you're going to have runts and mutants. And, you know, these are all things that we encounter. So if you're popping five seeds and you have two males, two herms, and a mutant, like, there's no reason to have clones of any of those. And you don't know that until 2 weeks into flower for some of these plants. But the idea being to lean heavier into reveg, you know, and it's not something that I have done a ton of. Like, I have had to reveg plants, but it's something I used to use as kind of a last resort. And now I'm leaning a little bit heavier into it with the idea of, like, I take cuts, like, this first round of trying this out, I guess I should say, is I took cuts right before flip. And then the idea being that they have 2 weeks to root. The plants have 2 weeks in flower to show balls and herms and those kinds of problems. But I started with like 37 seeds, I think was the first thing. I popped 37, which to me was like, holy crap. And I think I have four right now in the tent from those 37, you know, and that includes males and runts and herms. The one plant that I had a sex test for that I sex tested ended up being a genetic female that hermed, you know, so the point was kind of reiterated in my own thing, like 10% of what I popped is what ended up in flower. Yeah. And it's now moving forward. So that's kind of how I've approached, you know, I popped another 43 seeds the other day and I'm down to 29. You know, already, and they're like this big. So like, and again, like, we're talking, where does a plant count start? When they're this big, when they're rooted, when they're 6 inches, you know, and that's where it gets nuanced. But the other realistic thing is most seed packs are not going to pop 10 for 10 every time.
No, definitely not. And what got me a lot getting started was the keeping the plants around. You kind of just blew my mind thinking about the advantage of reveg, where I don't have to keep all these clones. The argument against reveg is it takes a while. Well, and the thought that just
plants are sometimes more pathogen susceptible.
Yeah, that as well. Longer root structure, longer time sitting in the same pot and not being repotted and stuff like that. But what just popped in my head is, if I'm taking a clone to maintain a mom of something I'm hunting, it's not getting ran for 8 to 10 weeks anyways, because I'm going to take those plants down. It's going to take me some time to wash it, dry it, cure it, try the cold cure, make my final selection. By that time, I've already got the next round of plants flipped in flower. So there's no reason why I should be worried about that timeline for reveg. And wow, what does that take off my plate to not have to take 50 clones and then narrow that down to one of each mom and make sure I don't mislabel those 12 plants and then wait till, like, same thing you're talking like, about. I'm going to throw eight of those away whenever they herm or are male. Once I get to sexing, I've kind of moved away from using sex tests as much. I really loved them at first until I experienced exactly what you said, where it's like, okay, I spent this money to try and save space and time and money in the garden, and half of the females still hermed anyways. So it's like, I'm still ending up in the same position as if I just went ahead and flipped the plants and started pulling everything with male signs. So, but buddy,
it's also like, it's a cost factor. Like, I love sex tests, don't get me wrong. Like, I think that there's a huge convenience factor to it, especially, you know, like, not for femmes obviously, but if you're running regs, like, it is a factor, especially if you're somebody who's limited by plant count and you want to pop more seeds. Like, it sucks if you've popped 10 and you're planning for 10 plants and six of them are dudes. Like, that's now you have 40% of what you were anticipating. But if you pop 40 seeds, that's a $400 investment or more, you know, to test all those. And again, lights, soil, nutrients, all the things, like, that might be worth it for you. But like you're saying, like, it might not be. You could test and get, you know, 20 of those tests are females and 10 of them herm. That's $100 on herm tests.
Yep.
Like, yeah. Is it worth it? If I had a budget and I was on a, you know, I'm on a call, I have a client out on the East Coast and they have $250,000 budget every year to buy seeds, which is like a hobby grower's dream. If I had that kind of budget and I was spending that kind of money on seeds, I would absolutely budget for testing. But, you know, for our sake, like, I think it's valuable if you have the extra budget and you're hunting a small amount of seeds. If you start popping a large amount, it can become cost prohibitive.
Yes. As a hobby grower, when you're not going to, like, capitalize on that, it's not a business investment that you're going to then make a return off of outside of the hash that you smoke. So, it's tricky. I mean,
you know, that brings up clone sales, you know, and that whole gray area of things. But I mean, I've made more money selling clones than I've ever made on selling weed.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. We'll come back to clones because I do want to talk about that for a hobby grower and in relation to this equation of limited space and the complications of a pheno hut. But something you said that you picked up from Shanti about the higher seed count volume, something I've started to do that people have basically told me I'm doing wrong in some cases in relation to hunting for hash, is I've become a lot more attuned with culling plants early. Because what I learned early on is a lot of people told me, or I even heard on other podcasts and stuff, that, well, the best plant was the runty one. And a lot of time the hash plant is going to be the ugly plant out of the bunch. And you're not hunting for the same traits as flower in terms of vigor and everything. For me, on the clone distributing thing with the Discord, that's a priority for me, is identifying easy to grow, stress resistant clones that can be passed off to a beginner and they're going to get good results and not have something like Sour Diesel that really requires an experienced grower to read dryback signals and stuff like that and not cause it to herm. I think for me, I've developed that mindset where I used to think I don't want to pop too many seeds because these are 10, 15 bucks a piece when you're buying beans from a higher tier hash breeding focused company. And then on top of that, I gotta keep all the plants because any one of these could be the winner. And I gotta wait till the very end to make my selection. Now I've more adopted the mindset of, like, I'm really looking for that one plant. So I might as well just pop the whole $200 pack because the one plant I'm trying to find is worth the $200. And that was the actual investment. It's not $20 a seed. It's $200 to find the pheno is with the investment that I made. So now I'm like, pop the whole pack. If they don't germinate, then that wasn't the plant to begin with. It didn't have vigor. It didn't want to root. It didn't throw tap roots as well as the other seeds. Right off the bat, there's that. Then if I have, you know, 30 seeds that I popped and five of them aren't developing a second node and the rest of them are on their, like, third and fourth node, I'll go ahead and throw those away at the beginning. And that's where people kind of say, oh, you're probably getting rid of something special in some cases. But for me, I have to remind myself of that
separate pursuit of it has to have vigor, it has to be stress resistant, it has to have check all these other boxes on top of high yield of hash per square foot. So I've had other plants when I used to keep the runts where I did keep a runt based on RTH and was like, okay, this returned higher to hash than the other plant, so it's better. And then later on you do the equation and you're like, well, that other plant had 600 grams fresh frozen weight. This one was only 300 grams and it took 3-4 more weeks to veg. It didn't take up as much real estate. It's got shitty fan leaf development, requires a lot more defoliation. You start to realize like, oh, just because that other plant hit lower RTH didn't mean it wasn't the better of the two plants. So I guess like on your point that you were just making about clones and, you know, that whole gray area of clone distribution and clone trading and everything like that, what's your general recommendation for a hobby grower that's like dead set on, I want to make hash?
Man, you know, so the two cuts that I run, that I have consistently run, that are two of my biggest hash cuts, are clones that I had purchased like a few months into growing. And for better or worse, I don't know. It's weird because like, if I look at my stable, I can't say that like I don't take cuts in, because there are cuts in my stable. But the last cut I took in was probably 2 or 3 years ago, and I'm much more inclined to pop seeds now. And I know that that's not a guaranteed route for a lot of people, but it's becoming more likely. You know, like we all, especially if you're in the Discord or, you know, your server, my server, any of the servers, like you're familiar with certain names that you hear often. These are hash producing breeders. They are focused on hash lines. And so that wasn't a thing, you know, like it might have been a much smaller, more niche thing, but it wasn't a widespread, widely known thing. Like, oh, this is somebody you should run. Like if you want to pop seeds and you're looking for hash, here's three breeders that you should check out, you know? And that wasn't the thing. You had to go buy a cut that was proven to be a hasher. Someone hunted 100 plants. They found the one that did the thing. And, you know, now all of a sudden, like that's the way to do it. But, you know, as somebody now who runs a lot of seed, I've had great success on hash plants from seed. And yes, the cuts that I bought that kind of started this journey were valuable to start. And again, like we talked about, like if I'd gotten 1% versus 4%, like where would my journey have gone? Like if I had hunted a pack of seeds and was like, you know what, nothing hashes, screw this. Everything's going to go to flower. I don't like hash, you know, whatever that journey might have been. Like the same thing could happen with a cut. Like you're saying, you could buy a cut from someone. It's supposedly does 5%. You're guaranteed to have a lot of material to play with. Like Snobby was talking about, like, it's nice to have that cushion to work with and try new things, Taffy Tech it or Sonic Cure it or whatever you want to do. But maybe it does 2% because you're a new grower and you are learning and you don't know what you're doing. And like, it's not the cut that necessarily like it, you started with a winter cut and you still ended up with not necessarily optimal results. So if you were like today, if you were like, I've never grown, I want to grow for hash, what would I do? If you have an unlimited budget, I would buy hash cuts. Like that's the cheat code. You know, that is the short path. If you've got a little bit more time, patience, I would tell you certain seed breeders to buy. And I would say, you know what, like find something that's flavor wise in your realm with these 3, 4, 5 people and pop a whole pack and see what you find, because you're going to find something that you've also never had and never seen and no one else has. And those kinds of things that are more valuable to me. You know, I tell people don't grow things that you can go buy at the store. Like from a convenience factor, it's way easier to go buy an ounce of ice cream cake at the store than it is to grow it. Like you have X amount of plants, you have 4 plants. Why would you grow something that every other licensed grow in the state is growing? And you could buy it for $100 an ounce. Like grow anything else.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
You know.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, my journey on that front was kind of the opposite of yours, where you described like you went ahead and washed an auto and hit a high yield. And then that kind of like inspired you of like, this is awesome. I want to take this path now with growing. That probably drove your genetic selection. Like I would imagine that drove your research and what kind of seeds to buy, strain selections to try and go in that direction of hash. What happened for me is everyone said, get a clone. I got a hold of a clone. And then I got a hold of other clones from local growers that weren't necessarily hash makers, but they were like, this is the frostiest plant that I have. Like, I'm pretty sure it'll do well for you. Just because it's covered doesn't mean that those heads are stable. Sometimes the really good hash plants don't really look that coated because they have large heads and they break off easily and they're stable. So it's like your ratio is high in that case. So just because it's totally coated doesn't really mean much in terms of hash. It's a different equation in terms of stability. So I had this clone, grew big. Frostiest
plant I ever had just yielded like shit.
Yeah, I had a sugarcane cut I got from somebody that was literally white. Yeah, it was literally white. And I posted online and everyone was like, oh my God, dude, that thing's gonna dump. I hit 1% and it was dirty hash because the material wasn't stable and it just obliterated in the wash and threw contaminants immediately. So, but back to my first hash wash for fresh frozen, it was a lemon gelato cut and hit 0.6% off of a 600 gram plant. Because I was air drying. Now, granted, I was a beginner grower. I'm sure I could push that further. My wash technique, air drying, all that has gotten way better. But still, I ended up with 3 grams of rosin off of an entire plant. And then I still had that beginner mindset of like, that was a QP, or that was 6 ounces. You know what I mean? And it's like I just threw $1,200 worth of weed away. These are 400 grams of rosin, you know what I mean? But it's like, that's not really true. Like, that was just a point in the journey. But then I go further down the clone path and I'm like, okay, I have to get hash cuts $500 plus this starting point. Whenever I'm going around on Instagram trying to follow people and find people who are posting what their library is and what they got available, and I was just like, man, I can't afford that. So then started the Discord.
Wild. I always forget not everybody has access to clone like Waxy was talking about, right? Like, mm-hmm. when he was on here,
dude. Yeah, you guys in California are in a different world than the Midwest, without a doubt. Feels like a different planet of cannabis. But anyways, I popped seeds. I did my own little micro hunts and everything. I found what I would consider my initial keepers, nothing I have now, but first plants that broke 3% return to hash. And I'm like, okay, that's worth running. Then I acquired some clones through clone trading since other people were interested in those keepers. Then I bought some really expensive clones. And then the reason I'm telling this story is if you're starting out and you have limited plant count and you take that route of collecting clones, don't forget that it takes you 12 to 14 weeks to grow each of them. I've ended up in a spot where I've got like 10 cuts, but I can't grow all them. So I have plants right now that I've been in veg that have been recloned like 8 times over the course of a year because I can't let it get really tall. It's got to stay under this height to meet the state regulations of being categorized either as a clone or as a teenager. And it's just like you end up in a lot of extra work to try to keep something around. So just kind of side note I wanted to make is don't have a bigger appetite than your tent can handle, because you end up in a spot that's pretty tough to manage where now you have these valuable clones that you don't want to lose, that you can't run for 6 months because you need to get through all these other plants. And then I ended up in that spot. And what I concluded from that was I was not getting as much joy out of the hobby. It started to become stressful to manage those clones, to decide what to go through next. And then ultimately landed back on the micro hunts because I found that's the funnest part to me, is watching, you know, 7 or 8 plants grow completely differently. Noticing that their stem rub is different, they have a different shape, their leaf structure is different, and then when you get into flower, their flower is different and different terpene profiles. It's like I was missing out on that whole part of the equation because I was stuck in this hash production focus, which it's like had to remind myself of like, this isn't a commercial pursuit. I have enough rosin for myself now. I need to just get something fun, you know?
And that's the big reason I was, as an outdoor person, that's the big reason I was going from seed all the time until this season, because like, honestly, I couldn't be able to keep those genetics going over the winter. As like, I'm gone for weeks at a time. Like, it's just not a convenient thing. And, you know, there aren't people that I trust with them, frankly, if I actually have a lot invested in them. So it was always like, well, here we go. We're going to get it in and we're going to let it go. But now I finally, in terms of the hash making side of things, no, look, if I don't have the space to phenohunt and I don't have a plant count to let me do it, I'm going to go acquire a couple of cuts and then I'm going to pop a couple of seeds too. That's what I've come to now. So like, this year I just got those four clones off Discord. I'm only going to run two of those things and then I'm going to pop some seeds because at least I know I have something that somebody has gotten 4 or 5% out of it, you know? And like, that's a big assurance versus like the last couple of years where I'm running old Oni stuff and I'm like, I think this should do something. I like, you know, and they have every time. Like, dude, Wilson like just dumps, right? Like no matter what, like, but honestly, it's just such a different frame of mind. And I think it's such a, I'm always locked up in the way that I do things. It's so interesting for me to hear what you guys and what your thought process is in terms of like how you're doing things or how you're approaching clone versus seed and that stuff. So, yeah.
Well, and like, to me, I lean hash, but I smoke a lot of flowers still. And so like my wife is a flower consumer. Like she'll smoke dabs with me, but if she's picking something up, it's flower. And if I'm picking something up, depends on the month, but you know, I trend hash more than she does. And so like when I'm picking plants, if we're, you know, I'm growing for both of us, half of those plants are predominantly for flower and half of them are for hash. So again, like I don't even have the full count. I'm looking at half of my count is hash related. So those got a hit. And at the same token, you know, I think that hash cuts to me are more valuable than flower cuts. And I say that as someone who hasn't come across a flower cut that I'm super stoked on. Like there's great flower cuts out there. I mean, like ice cream cake is a perfect example and I'm still growing it because it is just a great plant. But overall, like if you're telling me like, why would I spend on this? Like I feel like there's more value in the hash hunt as far as, you know, the amount of work for the potential of a true unicorn. Now, whether the unicorn being sold is actually a unicorn, totally different conversation. But like when you go to, you know, you were talking about it's $200 for the pack. Like when I bought a pack of pancakes seeds from Aficionado and they were like $300 for the pack. When I bought them, the seed bank that had them had popped a pack, hunted a cut, and found a cut that they liked best out of their pack. And you could buy the cut for $1,200. So again, it's like, do you want to go to the work to hunt a pack and spend $300 and then spend all the money on soil and nutrients and cloning and time and all of that? Or is it worth the extra $900 to skip it? Now, for me, I wanted to hunt it. But if it was a hash plant, like hazelnut cream is a perfect example, right? Mm-hmm. It's exotic genetics. Verde has a cut, Dab Logic.
Yeah, the Verde cut.
Yeah, and they hunted. I talked to them about it. They hunted through 10 packs and found that one. Or sorry, 30 packs and found that one. And then they popped 10 more packs trying to see if they could find something better. And they didn't find anything better. And like that is a standout cut. If it's the best hash plant out of 400 plants, like that's a hunt by anyone's count. And so like, I bought two packs that were 50% off that were 8 years old on the seed bank and thought that I was going to find the next cut. And like, you know, I had one pop and that one happened to be the Herm that I mentioned. So I could have just bought the cut. I don't know. Like, I think it's also where you're at in your grow journey. Like when you first start, like you were talking about, like you need to produce a certain amount to justify the investment, the work, the change in your lifestyle, all these different things. Once you're needs are met, so to speak, and you've got a backstash of hash and you've got, you know, flour, or at least you are on a cycle where you're, you know, it's coming down the pipeline regularly, then you can start to go like, well, yeah, like what happens if I've got 6 1-gallon plants and a 4x4? Who cares if it's inefficient? Like that, maybe I'll find some new flavors. I've got the other tent going that can work on efficiency, you know, and there's 6 plants in there or whatever. So that's where, like, to me, the value of the hunt is more. Like, I went through and wrote down every genetic that I had grown to date and whether it was from seed or from clone, and was surprised to see the trend. Like, I thought that I took more clones in, and when I was a newer grower, I did, but I ended up in the same situation you did. You know, I had a bunch of clones from Archive that I was able to get through, you know, some connections, and it took me like a full year to be able to flip all of them, like, and work them into my cycles and, you know, getting them worth running and vegging and all of the things. And so, like, taking in cuts is problematic, more problematic than buying seeds, which is a problem for every grower, but you have to keep the clone alive. You know, the seed you can vault, and you can, you know, you can have an excessive collection of seeds. If you have an excessive clone collection, that gets hard to manage.
Oh yeah. I haven't popped seeds in 4 months right now because of the clone situation for me right now, where I normally like to pop seeds every 2 months so that every single run I'm hunting something and alongside my proven keepers. Cause that way I can cover my production needs, make sure I have enough hash, but then still pursue something new, get new flavors. So other thing running clones is you get sick of the flavor profiles too. Like, I've ran all the stuff I have right now. I've been running it for over a year. So it's like, as stoked as other people might be on the cuts that I share, I'm burnt out. I'm like, I don't want any more clumps. I don't want any more grape cream cake. There's 2 ounces sitting in the freezer that I don't even really want to dab.
Yeah, no, I get that. Like, it's so the two cuts that I've had in the grow the longest are the sour papaya and the poontang pie. Both of those are from Bluegrass Hash, who was a friend of mine from the disc golf days. And at one of the Indo Expos, he was like, he kicked me a gram and was like, yo, you got to try this. You know, I've been making this, I'm growing it now. And I was like, yeah, cool, whatever. And then I remember it whenever I took it home and actually took a dab. I like texted him and me. I was like, this shit hits, like, this tastes good. I'm immediately baked. Like I want more, you know? And so we would trade grams and whatever, like, as growers. But then he had an opportunity to leave the state and go be a licensed, head up a licensed operation up in Montana. And so he was like, you know, if you want the cuts, this is your chance. Like, I will, you know, these are my cuts. This is what they cost. You want them? And I ended up splitting with another grower. We did a group buy. He bought one cut, I bought the other, and we both got both cuts. But like you said, like, at a certain point, is it a terp that you can get tired of? And so, like, for me, it's not. I could smoke sour papaya all day, every day, and be fine. I would just be lit. It's like that perfect punch for me. But my wife is like, can we get something else? Like, everything's sour papaya. Like, you know, and so that's where, like, that, you know, like.
Then you just start mixing it in with other stuff. You're like, I got all this. That's what ends up happening for me, where I'm like, let's just do a mixed wash and change this up a little bit.
Well, and it's such a good washer that, like, it's hard to cut it from the stable. You know, like, there have been times where, like, I selfed it last year and just made like a small preservation, which didn't go terribly well. I'm not bragging by any means, but if I got a few viable seeds, the idea was, if I ever lose this cut, I can, you know, maybe find my way back to it. But, you know, it does consistently 5 to 8% RTH. And so, like, that's a cut that has stuck around for a reason. But, you know, like, it's also something that I, at a certain point, have had so much of that, you know, like, I'm working on new flavors, working on growing and trying and finding new flavors. And finding hash strains is harder, even if you are popping hash packs. You know, I've been lucky on some, I've been unlucky on some.
Well, it's like, if you're looking for something on flower, in the end you don't find what you're looking for, it's still flower.
Right.
Like, yeah, if you're trying to wash ash, you got wet flower, right? Like, that's not going to work.
Yeah. I mean, I was really hopeful the refresher, which is what I'm holding, Tropicana cookies crossed with strawberry OG cookies. And I was like, with Trop cookies in there, man, that's going to wash. Like, it's got to wash. It did like 0.75%. And now it's amazing hash. It tastes exactly like the flower smells. But like you said, like, I got like a gram and a half from the, you know, like, it wasn't a great wash.
Well, something I never knew as a consumer, but I learned once I got into washing and was talking to more people and like networking in that side. When I lived in Denver for 4 years, I smoked an absolute shit ton of Trop cookies. I loved it. I love the effects. I work in media. It helps me be creative during the day. Doesn't make me super drowsy. I love Purple a good GMO. Pretty. Yeah, it's pretty. It has amazing smells and flavors. But at the same time, you can get sick of something if you smoke it constantly. And what I found interesting is talking to commercial washers out in Denver. They were like, no, dude, it doesn't actually wash that good. Like, it's super popular and people love the profile. But I had multiple people tell me like, oh, well, my cut only hits like 2.8%. And compared to like their GMO hitting 8%. So then it's like, once I made that connection, I was like, okay, this makes sense why there's, you know, 25% of what's in stock at every dispensary is some GMO cross. The burgers, yeah. You got the, you know, Trop Santo, Trop Cookies cross GMO. Then you got just so many GMO crosses because it stabilizes that yield and makes it more commercially viable. But I think it's a misconception I had too of like, oh, Trop Cookies must wash well because it's so popular. But I had people tell me, no, we just run that because it gets off the shelves quickly. Like, we make our money back fast.
That's an interesting point you bring up. So like the commercialization of this industry and this plant, you know, is inevitable, but it also has affected things like pheno hunts because commercially, you know, they're popping a lot of seeds, a lot more than we are able to as home hobby growers. And when we see something repeatedly on a shelf, we're like, wow, that must be good. Like, you know, that must have done well for them or whatever it may be. But a lot of those selections are made, like you said, based on yields, based on commercial viability, and not, wow, that's a terp profile we've never seen in hash, you know, or wow, we don't ever see those levels of CBG come through in rosin or whatever it is, you know, that's not yield focused. And obviously yields matter, but like, you could have something that's slightly less yield, but way more distinct, and commercially that's less viable. So we're seeing that those selections then play out from that bias as consumers become growers, you know, the bias until that is unlearned, that's being passed down, like inevitably all the way down to the phenos.
It's really interesting. Yeah. It's just, it's a completely different way of thinking.
Yeah. On the pheno hunting front, it's like, for me, I feel like I have those quote unquote commercially viable cuts now. So I can always lean back on those if I need volume just to keep my stash full. But now I'm like knowingly going down a hunting journey that could end up being a fool's errand where I want to find something really unique, more old school terps. I want to find a good sour. I want to find a good haze.
Well, you're already dipping in the rare pool. You're like, I want to shoot in an even bigger bucket, like,
yes, right. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I actually am looking for a haze washer. That's my newest.
Yeah, I'm like I caught some fish in this 5 gallon bucket. I'm ready for the ocean. I think I'll be pretty good. But no, I mean it's probably gonna be more of a fool's errand, but I just, even though I can't have a huge plant count or anything like that, I feel like I want to find something that I feel is special, and even if it only hits 2%, that's fine for me on a head stash front or potential like comp entry or something along those lines. So that's more my pursuit for this year, is like different effects, completely different profiles. That's not all these fruit cookies driven profiles.
And we're growing for ourselves, right? So I mean, like, I heard somebody on one of the podcasts I was listening to today, the Canna Cabana podcast, they were talking about like, yields don't matter after a certain point if you are truly only growing for yourself, because you can only smoke so much. So like, if you're a heavy smoker, you need a lot produced. But if you're a lighter smoker, you may be super happy with 6 ounces off of a 4x410. If, you know, they may be the dankest, most special, whatever plants you've ever grown. But like, if that's all, if you only smoke a bowl or a puff off a bowl every night, like, you're not going to blow through that by the time you harvest again. And so like, like you said, like it really depends on what we're growing for, like from a commercially viable standpoint or other things. Like I can lean into the sour papaya and know that if I'm low on my head stash, I can run a sour papaya, I can put one in the corner, and she's just gonna dump. And like no matter what else happens in the tent, I'm gonna have some hash. But at the same token, like I had 3 years worth of papaya melt in my freezer that I had to figure out what to do with. So, there's eventually the head stash. You're like, I have so much hash in the head stash. You open up the head stash and it's all the same strain. It's just different cycles and different vintages and different, whatevers.
That's a great point.
Vintage. I like calling
Well, and
it that.
that's an interesting thing too, especially when you're doing outdoor only, right? Because you got one shot a year, and like so you get really sick of the same thing after a while. It's I gotta say. So the idea is I'm trying to do enough where I, after switching it out for a couple of years, I actually do have a backlog of a variety. Like I have to go about creating that variety in a different way because I can't go to like, look, I'm gonna do four runs this year. Like it's just not a luxury I have.
Well, I mean, unless you got a ton of freezer space, and then you can freeze crops indefinitely and keep them
No,
around and
that's
pull up
true.
your library and go, I'd like to wash a pound of that from 2 years ago right now.
Yeah, I'm curious at how
That'd be
long you actually have on
hilarious. A
flower.
fresh frozen library. You just do all
Yeah.
small batch washes.
I imagine it looked like the like a meat locker just with stuff hung up, cataloged, but
Well, I was talking to Sunstone about it. So you may know them, Sonoma. Sunstone out in Santa Barbara. They are okay. So they're a winery. This is such a fun story. So I know this guy named Kalen that I met in my time in LA. Kalen's a very smart, science-oriented individual who has a nanoemulsification process for rosin and getting drinks infused, and really passionate about that. But we were talking about it, and he was like, "I'm working with this winery," and I was like, "Hold up. You're working with a winery? Like, tell me more." And so this guy, Teddy, bought a winery specifically to sell weed and to grow weed. And that doesn't align for a lot of people, but his whole premise was like, we have a captive audience that understands drinking as an experience. That's their modality. And so adding other active ingredients, the terroir and appellations of origin and in California being coming around and big, obviously with wine, but also now with cannabis. The idea was like grow sun-grown outdoor cannabis in the vineyard right next to the grapes and obviously play off the mycelium, but also truly like wine, there are vintages then. And then they take the whole crop, they turn it into rosin, and then they turn that rosin into these infused drinks that are served and demoed and introduced right alongside the wines. And it's a fascinating concept because it
Wow.
reimagines that cannabis is as smokable as many of us think about it, but and wines, they're not in the wine industry, they're in the drink industry, and so that's like an interesting pivot. But seeing that applied, there's also this advantage of, okay, if you take an entire outdoor crop and you turn it all into rosin, good or bad yields, you've got a finite amount. Say, there's 5 milligrams in these drinks. It doesn't take a whole lot of rosin to produce a batch of these. So you can have
No.
a back library of rosins and you can dip in and go, let's pull out the 2020 vintage of Trop Cookies. That was a great fire year. Let's do a re-release, a limited re-release of these, this vintage
That's very
drink.
cool.
So
Yeah,
there's
it's
so
very
many
cool.
haven't even
What form is
scratched.
the drink?
It's
Like,
a
are
seltzer.
they okay? They're doing like a clear seltzer sort of thing.
They have a few different flavors. They just had a big event there. I was trying to make it out, but I had family in town, so I didn't end up out there. But
The interesting
it's a
thing
cool
would
project.
be
Sounds there's a natural
the
overlap.
degradation and what happens with degradation on it, right? Because like the interesting thing with wine, the reason the vintages matter is that the thing evolves over time and changes, and we can assume there's some sort of degradation in a, like is it canned
And
or is
how
it
cold does it
bottled?
have to be to stay,
Is it bottled?
Oh well, the drinks are, yeah, but I was talking about the rosin, like just keeping the rosin the main ingredient, for each crop, doing that. I don't know how that. I would imagine the drinks have a shelf life like every other cannabis product, whether it's.
Oh, I thought you were talking about like pulling the library out of the drinks.
Oh yeah, no, that no, I was talking about like the main ingredient, like for each
Ah,
batch,
got it. Well,
the
see, that
grape.
makes a lot more sense.
The grapes for the wine, and then come back and be like, what? Go grab a bushel of those grapes from this year. Like, let's make another batch.
Well, and the idea
Very
of
cool.
pairing terps with the flavor of the beverage, that's like super cool idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many uses for rosin outside of just dabbing it. I love basically making, I guess, an alcohol tincture. I don't know if it's RSO, but FICO, I guess, is technically what it would be. But using the spent bags to make FICO and then just making capsules with that. That's been one of my new favorite things. I was trying to make gummies and all that, but then it's like they can go bad a lot more easily, and hard candy. End up wanting to eat a bunch of candy. Yeah, hard candy. I see
you. But making, it's sugar, like you said. Like it's sugar, it's corn syrup, it's all the things. Like they're healthy recipes, but at the end of the day, it's candy.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that makes me want to eat more and more and more of it.
Back to the idea of like the library of vintages, right? For rosin or something like that. It'll be interesting to see as people have these like serious head stashes that are aging. It'll be interesting to see what happens to that over time, though. Like what I was saying earlier, I think as those change, it's like a temple ball that's 5 years old. It has like a completely different thing going on for it than it did when it was like fresh, right? Like there's a curing process that's still happening over time. It's going to be interesting to see like what happens with some of those head stashes as they become 10 years old, right? Like
are they still and how best to preserve them, like
yeah, right?
So, like if you don't want the change, like it to some the change is good, like a temple ball, but like if you're like, I want this to stay exactly like this is fresh press, I want it to stay here, you know, like how cold is cold enough to not do it basically slow to a zero, you know, that
change. Cryogenic.
Yeah.
It's probably coming.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, like, and now Sonic Cure, like that blew my mind. I bought one of those on Amazon like the next day and I still haven't tried it out. I'm going to try it on this next run, but I was like, this is tech for $80. Like, come on now. Like you're going to turn 2 weeks of curing in a jar into like 2 hours. Like this is, worst case, I have a cleaner for all my tools now. You know, like worst case for $80, I have a sterile cleaner.
I go back. Is that really curing? It's just nucleation, right?
It's just like, nucleation. Yeah.
It's just and nucleation. This, but
yeah.
It's
but is sweet. Is curing really curing? I mean, you know, there's an argument to be had. Like, does in 2 weeks, does curing truly happen? You know, like if you're
talking, or do you even want curing to happen? Like, is the idea is a better for most people?
What just is want
fresh press in a cold cured, like, you know, form?
Yeah. Well, and it's like this gets into the language side of this, which is like we're in an ever evolving space, but we're also in a space that's very lazy with its language. And I say that with the, you know, most respect, but like we use things very loosely to refer to a lot of different things. It's, you know, like fuck, like you can apply that word to so many different things. It's like hash is it hash of its dry sift? Is it hash of its bubble hash? Is it hash of its Piatella? Is it hash of its, you know, like, and we, you know, at the same time, you're like, hey, did you bring any hash with you? Like, we're not saying, hey, did you bring any traditionally pressed Moroccan hash with you? I'd love to try some of the 5-year. Like, that's not what's being said, even though that's very specifically what hash means. And so, like, we say it with terps and we say it with, there's a lot of different colloquialisms in the space, but like with curing, you know, like it's a great example, cold cure. Like, is a cold cure cold? And what is the level of cold it has to be to cold cure? Like to most people, that's room temp or less. But by definition, is that cold? You know, and that's where we get real loose with these languages. And to us, to me, I should say, like cold cure is the opposite of heat cure. Like there's no added heat. That's a cold cure. But again, if you're in a room that's 80 or 90 degrees, is that a heat cure? Is it a cold cure? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, somebody needs to make like an international hash association and sit down and hash all this out and set some standards.
Yeah, Frenchie hashed a lot of it out for us. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of taxonomy that hasn't been properly laid out for sure.
I think it's
going to be some kind of constitutional convention of hash makers to determine the standards and ways of the industry.
What actually matters, you know, and that's the other side of this coin is like we could all convene at the annual convention of hash makers and we could agree whether or not the new term is approved.
I was saying that jokingly.
We could just decide right here and just have it over with. And like,
no,
just
my thing, I think you talked about this on Instagram, Ben, that once society decides to call things a thing, you can't change it. There's no takesy backsies on that. Like,
Amen.
Like, hey, everybody, stop saying that.
And, you know, you can try to guide it. It's like the whole cannabis versus pot versus weed thing. You know, like we have as an industry, we've positioned ourselves away from the old stereotypes that have come with some of these terms. But like, you know, there's the air of like, does cannabis change things? Yeah, it does. In certain circles, in certain senses, sure. But like at the end of the day, it's the same thing. And so like, does it matter that somebody's out there calling it pot? Do you need to correct them? I don't know. I mean, like, maybe, but
as long as there's no like, I get the marijuana one, like with the racist connotations and stuff that are behind it. I get that one, but like that one I can do without. Like, I'll claim guilt of having been that asshole that has been like, if someone just doesn't know or has never heard anything about, like, you know, like it's not like the coolest term, right? But so I gotta say,
well, that's it's a great one because different. Most of these laws are written as marijuana laws. Most of the laws that I read are written as marijuana laws. And so like this came up during my wife's advocacy days. Like there were some people who were, you know, like we cannot refer to patients as medical marijuana patients. They need to be medical cannabis patients. And they need to, you know, have cannabis growing rights. It's not marijuana growing rights and all these different things. And it's like, look, like ideologically, I understand where you're coming from and you may be completely right, but recodifying all this language, like going back and saying, totally. You know what, let's rewrite every amendment that's legalized weed, and just to, you know, like that, it's not a productive use of our time, and it creates these weird inefficacies in the system that, like, then the people who don't want weed to be legal are gonna be like, oh, look at this, like they can't even agree what it's called or whatever. You know, there's always some sort of pushback, and anytime you reopen that wound, reopen that discussion, you're reinviting, like, maybe sentiment has changed. You know, Colorado was able to get a state amendment to the Constitution. Like, could we do that again to change the word? I don't know. I think a lot of people would be like, really? Like, no, nah, it's legal. Like, what do we need this for?
No.
So, it gets tricky. Like, there's some states that have marijuana with an H still. And, like, that's what the law says. Oh, so,
yeah. Like the old advertisement
change. Like that's a hard argument to try and get on the ballot of like, we need to retitle this.
Yeah. We should just change it all of them to just say
no longer the Medical Marijuana Act. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just weed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you know, even that is like, well, that's so slang. You need to say cannabis, you know.
It has to be
know?
Cannabis. And the whole, I mean, some people even still caught up on the medical versus recreational. Like, I'm like, I do both.
I think medical is going to die. And that's something I've been saying for a while. Like, you could make the argument that all cannabis use is medical, but there's no way this goes full scale legal with a dual system of exemptions.
Yeah.
Like you're not going to be able to have an extra card that says the rules don't apply to me. I can buy 20 times what you can and I can grow 20 times what you can. Like it would be impossible to regulate.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's something we probably don't have time to get into, but I've wondered what the discussion of descheduling. It's like, okay, if it gets descheduled, it's on the same level as Tylenol. You can't make Tylenol at home. So,
I mean, if they flip the switch tomorrow, are you going to kill all your plants?
Yes.
Yeah, as far as the recording goes. Yeah. But I mean, like, you know, that's the argument is it's like, you know, like I've been saying that like there is a group of people, especially from states that aren't friendly to growing, that will jump on any grow post and they'll say like, oh, you know, still not legal in my state, whatever. Typically it's New Jersey. I hear this all the time. Well, I wish New Jersey didn't have it as a felony still. And it's like, so do I. Like for you, I wish it wasn't a felony, but it's the cannabis equivalent of like, must be nice. And the unfortunate side of this is, you know, like we don't want to encourage anyone to do something illegally, but cannabis hasn't been legal all that long and people have been growing it. So like, you know, if you can put the two and two together there, like, even if the law changed tomorrow, all you got to do is shut your mouth and do whatever the hell you want. You know, like, there's a certain extent to, like, I joke with my wife, I'm like, we could live in the middle of BFE, North Carolina for 50 grand for this 10 acre parcel, but I would just have to keep my mouth shut. And that's hard.
Yeah. Know yourself, know your opponent, fight a thousand battles without defeat, right?
This legal thing, you know, like, I'm very open about who I am and growing and those kinds of things. And that's a benefit of the legality. You know, it's not something like, I'm sure even, you know, Sonoma, like, it's not a, it wasn't the culture to be as forthcoming.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a prohibition state in the Midwest, and so yeah, like, I've been out here my whole adult life, but yeah, like, I grew up where, like, you know,
no bueno.
Yeah, no bueno, like, at all. Like, culture, still culturally no bueno. Like, where I'm from, I'm guessing will be the very last state to legalize anything that has anything to do with fun.
Well, that sounds like Kansas.
Yeah, it's a lot like Kansas. We'll just say that.
I mean, I moved to Missouri and was shocked that Columbia had decriminalized in like the 90s. Like,
yeah,
Missouri, Columbia was really weed friendly for a state that is not, or wasn't, you know.
Yeah,
I honestly, I think Missouri, you guys have just great laws. Honestly, especially on the medical side of things, like,
yeah,
pretty fantastic. Yeah,
and I mean, because of that, I try to follow them to the T, because I mean, me and Ben go way back to college, and he mentioned earlier when we were talking, it's been 10 years, so we can talk about it, but we were open blasting with a honeybee extractor in like 2013. And open blasting. That's not at all what we call it. We're sticking a can in a plastic tube and letting it all pour into a Pyrex dish, and had no idea how dumb that was.
And how stoked were you when you were?
Oh, dude, we were so stoked, because you had no access to concentrates. That was like some of the first concentrates we smoked, basically, and we were like, "This is insane! We made this."
There was some great pot. You had some great pot that I remember making that batch. And I remember being like, this is the best tasting stuff we had, and finding a gram of it like years later when I moved to Chicago, and being like, oh shit, I remember exactly what this was, and taking a dab, and the whole thing like sparkled all over my nail. And like, you know, it's not something you should be dabbing.
Not the clean.
Crackle pop.
Yeah. But Columbia was nice. But due to that, and being a kid and now being an adult and having decent laws here, I'm like, I'm going to stick to these, because it feels crazy to me that the way things were as a kid. And then now it's like, I can do this completely legally and like add a plant count where I can do little micro hunts and have keepers and keep clones around and everything. So I really like how we have it here. I think there's still some states that are better, but I mean, your plant count's pretty low in Colorado, to my understanding.
Like, I have an EPC, so I can have up to 24, and then Longmont allows 30 per household. So with my wife, even as just a rec patient, or not a patient, but just a rec consumer, we could have 30. So that's really not the norm, like out here in the metro Denver areas, but you know, like, I'm curious, because you mentioned a few states are better. Like, this has been a question I've been asking a lot of people, is what states do you feel are the best for home grow laws?
To my limited understanding, I feel like Michigan is potentially the best. You have a lot better understanding and research level on this, so.
Well, no, because it's like, it's a dual factor question, right? It's like, we, on the one hand, best meaning like, what is the most, the least restrictive permission? You know, it's like an open-ended kind of would be ideal. Yeah. You can just grow, period. But we don't have that in many states. So what is the most open-ended? And then the back end of that is like, from a best legislative protection standpoint is, how hard would this be to screw up? Meaning, like in Colorado, it would be very hard to change a state constitutional amendment. But in some of these states, this was just a rider on a bill, you know, and that could be very easily erased or undone or, you know, legislated mm-hmm. away through whatever action. And so, like, that's something that, you know, we see all these markets change. Oklahoma was amazing. And then they were like, whoa, we screwed this up. We have so much going on, and they had to rein things in, you know, mm-hmm. and that's fine. But that's where the question is to me, because like, I've been asked by a few people to kind of head up like a national home grower, hobby grower kind of advocacy group. And the first logical thing to me is to have language, right? You need legal language. This is what we're going after. We want every person to have the right to grow an unlimited amount of pot plants, you know, probably not going to pass. But if you were like, the standard that we want is that everyone can grow, say, 24 plants per household and could easily apply for a commercial permit for $50 a year. Hypothetically, say that's already written in Nebraska's law. Well, we have then precedent, and you could say, okay, look, this is a market that's doing it. This is the language that works. And then you could jump on that train and try to get those laws instilled everywhere. And it brings up the third point of this is like the right to sell. As a home grower, do you have the right to sell your wheat? Should you have the right to sell your wheat? And depending on the state, depending on the person, that question will vary. I think that, you know, it's a tough question to answer, because my thought process is that rather than you should just be able to willy-nilly sell whatever you grow and make at home, I think it should be so accessible to do so within the system that it would make sense, that it wouldn't make sense not to. You know, we look at Oklahoma and Maine as two primary examples. Oklahoma, it was $2,500 in a driver's license, and you could sell the weed you grew in your basement to a dispensary. Like, that's an accessible license to a grower who wants to sell. Like, if you want to sell, $2,500 is not that big of an investment on top of all the other stuff you're spending, versus having to have seven figures in a bank liquid and having to have this much collateral and this.
That was the trick answer to your question that I was going to say is, well, the best state is the one where you go commercial very, very affordably.
Yeah. But that's the case, you know, like in Maine, same thing, like you can become a caregiver and you can do these things, and there is a path to legal sales. And there's a whole bunch of problems with our legal system, but like, the easier that path is, the less it matters whether or not you could sell out your backyard. You know, like people, if it's $50 a year for you to be able to have a permit that says I grow outdoor weed in my backyard and I sell it at the farmer's market, $50 is really not that big of a deal. You know, like, and if you were like, well, I don't want to pay, I'm going to sell it anyway, that's just kind of, you know, simple as far as the approach, you know, it's not the smartest. So I don't think it's an inherent, you know, on philosophical level, sure, you should have the right to sell whatever you want to sell. But from a realistic level, looking at the rest of the world and how it's set up, if you just make it accessible to enter the market, then unlicensed sales really aren't that big of an argument, like whether or not they're legal or not.
Yeah. I mean, that would generate the most tax revenue, hands down. But
well, the problem with the tax revenue pitch is it does run against the home grower, you know?
Yeah. That's would require everybody reporting everything, but that sounds a whole other episode. And I am not experienced to discuss the legalities.
We're going to have a lawyer and a CPA.
I know. I need to meet.
And it'll be the worst episode in the history of podcasts.
Yeah. If you interview a lawyer that makes hobby hash and grows weed for fun, definitely point them in my direction.
Right.
No problem.
Love to connect.
Yeah, if you're out there listening at us.
Yeah, if you're a lawyer who makes hash.
Hey, lawyer who makes hash in their basement.
Yeah. I want to talk to you.
Someone's going, that's me. Let's hang out.
Right now, this is the call. The bat signal's up. Let us know.
All right. Well, with that, Sonny, you want to get into our five hashy questions?
Man, time just flew by. We'll just jump right into it. All right. So tell us about the first time you bought weed.
First time I bought weed was at Mizzou. This is fun because, like we said, we can talk about this now. So I bought weed. I bought weed from somebody that was moving into the dorm. I didn't smoke weed until I moved to Mizzou. So the first gram I bought was like, you know, high grade, top shelf, whatever, $20 a gram. And the guy across the hall, he connected with some people. I won't reveal who he is and where they came from, but you know, he was like, yeah, I'm in this group and, you know, I have access. And so I was like, okay, cool. Bought a gram. I don't know what it was, but I was one of those guys who started on, you know, good nug. And it wasn't, I went from good nug to mids like in like a 2 weeks time, because I had no idea. And I had just bought weed for $20 a gram. And someone was like, I can get you an ounce for 80. I was like, fuck off. Really? Yeah, I'm in. Like, that's 4 grams. Where do you get your ounces? That thing came back. It was brown. It was stems. It was seeds. It was Missouri swag.
Yeah.
I remember that. That old
good stuff. Yeah, that's what I grew up with, baby.
Roll it up in a receipt paper. Real good stuff. Yeah.
So bad. So bad. All right. So who's your biggest hash-making influence?
Biggest hash-making influence? Man, that's a tough one. You know, I always credit Frenchie, you know, it's hard not to, Bubble Man as well. But people who like directly influence me, I would say are more on the local front. You know, they're smaller people. There's a company or a brand, whatever you want to call it. Ice Cream Man Melts. The guy behind that was a big help. He actually sold me my first freeze dryer. I bought it used off of him. Simple Hash, which is Fidel Hash Bro. He is another hash maker out here in Denver that, you know, we would just talk about different techniques and things and how he did it. Giggle Bear, you know, Giggle Bear, I think is in the Discord. He's another mountain guy out here. And again, like just talking tech and seeing what things are. But like, I think that those, like I listen to the Hashishin and I listen to a lot of the, you know, Between Two Heads and some of these hash podcasts, excuse me. And like, there's a lot to be learned without question. And I do learn a lot from the makers that are interviewed and their processes, but I wouldn't say that I have any one particular, like larger maker that's inspired me, you know, in a way, or like that I've been like a diehard, like, oh, I really like this guy and his style of washing or his methodology or his thought processes. It's, I feel like I've learned more incrementally from the local people. And then it's like those sub 1% optimizations that you pick up in listening to somebody who does this commercially and runs thousands of grams. And, you know, you're like, oh, wow, that's a quick tweak that I could do in my process. But like 90% of the process came from talking to the guys you're growing.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. So next question, cold cure or fresh press?
I like cold cure. I say that I take a gram of fresh press out of every batch to smoke while I wait for the cure, but I like the texture of cure. I always said batter or better. So like I preferred live batter to diamonds. I think it's just, it's easier to work with, easier to carry. It's all the things.
Yeah. I think a lot of times it depends on your lifestyle. For people who like just dab at nighttime and they have their like space and their rig set up and it's like more of ritual and they want to take 20 minutes doing it. If you're moving around town and trying to have a jar in your pocket, cold cure is almost always the way to go. So
I'll flip the question on you. Cold cure or jam?
To me or Sonny?
Or either of you.
You go first, Sonny.
Generally speaking, cold cure. But I go through phases where I love jams. I love it. And I love having them next to each other. Like I like having maybe cold cure early in the day and jam of the same thing later in the day, because like that contrast is so interesting to me, right? Like in terms of the profile. But I'd probably have to say cold cure if it's the go-to. Like it's just so easy to handle, I think, is a lot to it. And something about the little bit of a cure. Yeah, it does just something for the profile over fresh press, in my opinion.
Yeah, I feel like for me, it's kind of cultivar dependent, because I almost feel like, and this might be a dumb way to look at it, I don't know, but I look at a jam as like applying that heat cure is almost like speeding up what would happen over time. So with a cold cure, you have a larger variable to play with of leaving it out at room temperature and experiencing how the terpene profile changes over time. With the jam, I kind of feel like you're speeding that process up. So like when you have the opportunity, like you said, Sonny, of having the cold cure and the jam side by side, I kind of feel like if you left that cold cure sitting out at room temp for a month, it starts to take on more of that profile of the jam. And I think generally jams are a little bit smoother on my throat, which is a sign of, you know, the more volatile terpenes off gassing through that heated process.
I'm going to test this. I'm going to test this at least anecdotally. Now I have something I need to test. So
there you go.
Thank you. There you go. All right. So we'll move it along. Favorite strain you've grown and or washed?
Favorite strain I've grown or washed? I mean, the sour papaya is definitely up there. I hate to use it because it's a clone and it wasn't something I hunted from seed. From seed, I really like the red smoothie from Terp Fountain. I was lucky to get a pretty terpy, a good yielding a variety from that pack. It's on the list actually to pop the rest of them and see if I could find something better. But really liked that. I went down the rabbit hole and I bought a bunch of his gear. So I've run a few of the packs, but that one stands out. It's still in the stable. So I mean, and then you know, if you want to say something fun, I made my first cross. I made a feminized cross 2 years ago. I only got like 12 seeds. The reversal wasn't perfect. Nothing went perfect with it, but I got like 12 seeds and I have one plant that I've kept around and has done well and been fun. So that would be, I guess, something that from no one else but myself.
That's cool. All right. So this one's going to be, I think you already talked about this. When's the last time you smoked flower?
Today. Yeah, I smoke a lot of flower for a hash consumer. You know, I was listening to that on one of the podcasts where you were talking about the kind of the natural trend of like going from flower to hash. And like when I first started dabbing, that was absolutely the case. Like I would turn down blunts and I would turn down joints and I would, you know, like, no, I don't smoke flower. Like we only dab around here kind of thing. And at a certain point, I don't know what happened, but I think it probably had to do with, you know, outdoors and dabs not being as, now they're way more convenient with, you know, all these electronic devices, but originally with a blowtorch and a rig and a pelly and all these things, like a joint or a blunt was just so much easier to just spark up at the top of a mountain. And now like I go through phases. I've been trying to cut back on blunts. I love blunts. And when I'm not smoking blunts, I smoke more hash. But when I allow myself, you know, those months of like, you can go ahead and smoke blunts. Like I smoke a lot of flower, like by weight, like I smoke a lot of flower, but you know, it just comes in waves.
For sure.
All right. All right. So last question, who's someone else you'd like to hear us talk to?
Yeah. Who's somebody else I'd like to hear you talk to? I think Giggle Bear would be cool to talk to, 'cause he's another hobby guy. Hash people, I'm assuming, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, generally.
I was gonna say, I mean, I guess either of the, you know, Simple Hash, Fidel Hash Bro would be cool just because he's kind of got an interesting story. Terp Fountain's a little bit out as far as like, I mean, maybe still kind of in the realm of a hobbyist, but like he started as a hobby, like a hash guy. He started as hash and went into breeding. So I mean, there may be an avenue there. I know he was on the Hashy Chin and he's done a few other things.
For sure.
But yeah, I don't, you know, it's funny, like I don't know any one particular hash maker that hasn't, like the people that we all know that come to mind have been covered extensively, have done a lot of these podcasts and interviews, and most of them have grown beyond the scale of what we do. So when I think about the people in my life that are still small scale, still just kind of doing this for fun, like those, you know, those are some of the first people that come to mind.
For sure.
Right. Perfect. All right. Well, guess it. We made it. Like that's it. Bag, you are off the hook. Yeah, officially. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to have you. You've got a really interesting perspective on things, given your like just got really diverse background.
Yeah, before we wrap up, how can people connect with you, Ben, and learn about Hobby Grow?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can just dive right down the rabbit hole and go to thehobbygrow.com, and that's going to sign you up for the newsletter. I do a weekly grow news, which is kind of me curating all of the newsletters and things that I'm actively listening to and paying attention to in the weed industry, and just scraping out the home grow news, because that's all that we care about is home growers. And, you know, also deep dives and insights and things like that. But if you want to find me on social, it's cannabinoid with an E, like Ben is the name. Cannabinoid on Instagram and Twitter. And then on LinkedIn, you could probably just search Ben Owens or Hobby Grower. That would probably pull you up the easiest way. LinkedIn's a little bit, you know, less username oriented, so. Great. Oh, and great. Hobby Hash. I guess if you want to take the class, like there's a free 7-day crash course on making solventless extracts at home, and you can take that at hobbyhash.com.
Perfect.
Perfect. All right. Well, on behalf of myself and Hashy, stay hashy, everyone.